This is Neutral Milk Hotel and Airplanes on the Sea. Jeff Magnum of Neutral Milk on the Hill was born on this day in 1970. Now we jump into our program. We are here now with Piper Kerman, who is author, of course, of the memoir Orange is the New Black, My Year in a Women's Prison. The book was adapted by Jenji Cohen to the Emmy and Peabody Award-winning series, the same name on Netflix. She works with Spitfire Strategies, which is a communications consultancy with nonprofits, philanthropies, and other organizations working in the public interest. And this year, Piper was awarded the Justice Trailblazer Award from the John Jay Center on Media, Crime, and Justice, and the Constitutional Commentary Award from the Constitutional Project, and will be here on Monday for the Big Change Baltimore event with the Open Society Institute here in Baltimore. And Piper, welcome. Good to have you with us on the program.
Oh, thanks so much. That's a lovely welcome. I appreciate it.
Good to have you with us. And folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can log on to our Facebook pages. Of course, tweet me at Mark Steiner. Write to us at talk@steinershow.org, 410-319-8888. Now, I suppose a lot of people, not everybody, I'm going to make assumptions here, know your story, but many people watched Orange is the New Black. There's been a lot of critique of it, which we can talk a little bit about. But let's go back to the beginning, because this whole story is based on your experience as a middle-class young white woman from Connecticut who got caught up in a world with your lover, who was also a lover to a drug kingpin, and you ended up going to prison.
Yes, I'm actually not from Connecticut. That's Piper Chapman, not
Oh, that's right. That's not you. Excuse me. Sorry about that. Right.
No, but that's fair enough. Boston, close enough. Right?
Close enough. New England.
Yes, I served 13 months of a 15-month sentence in federal prison from 2004 to 2005. I was sent to prison for a first-time nonviolent drug offense, like many millions of other Americans have been. You're correct that as a middle-class white woman, I don't match up to the profile of the people we have been most likely to incarcerate in this country, which is, of course, poor people of color. But I am, like many other women who are incarcerated in this country, sort of a first-time low-level offender.
So, and I think that, you know, obviously this thing, the book caught hold of people, but the series really has kind of opened the world to a world. It's interesting, one of the things that I read that Kenji said about the series and the book, and I think that it's important. I'm going to just read this because I think when she asked the question about race and the TV series, she said, "You're not going to go into a network and sell a show on a really fascinating tales of black women and Latina women and old women and criminals. But if you take this white girl, this sort of fish out of water, and you follow her in, you can then expand your world and tell all those other stories. But it's hard to sell just to go in and try to sell those stories initially. The girl next door, the cool blonde, is a very easy access point and is relatable to a lot of audiences, a lot of networks looking for a certain demographic." So what she's basically saying is to get to the story you really wanted to get to as well, and you talk about a lot, you almost have to be subversive to get there.
Yeah, I mean, I think Jenji is a really, actually, very direct and blunt person.
I like that.
I thought that was a really clear-cut answer from her. I mean, I think it's a sad commentary on the world that you can't go into a major media company and sell a story about, you know, about the incredible diversity of America, and that you have to hinge on this Trojan horse. She really calls that character of Piper Chapman a Trojan horse that gets some viewers into that setting. Though, of course, you know, the amazing thing that she's done in the show is she's adapted my book and she's really given an incredible range of different protagonists. One of the things I think that is the strength of the show is that it's not really just about one protagonist. It's not about Walter White or Tony Soprano. It's about an incredible range of primarily female protagonists.
So, coming back to your book and your experiences, which you're going to be talking about here when you get to Washington, get to Baltimore on Monday, because I think that clearly, I mean, as you've written before, I've seen in interviews, you've come from a progressive family. Your parents have always believed in social justice, but if people don't, I think for many people in America, if you don't spend time in a prison working, if you don't spend time in a prison incarcerated, you don't understand how deeply important it is for us to change the system.
Yeah. I think especially when if we are concerned about Americans who live with the least, if we are concerned about Americans who have the biggest gap in opportunity, the least access to healthcare, access to schools, which are truly failing, you know, if we're concerned about people who are living with very little, even though we're the richest country in the world still, then we have to be concerned about prisons and jails and about the criminal justice system, because increasingly, the criminal justice system sort of is this revolving door for our most vulnerable communities. And, you know, something that many people don't know is that 80% of people who are accused of a crime are too poor to afford a lawyer. Almost
right.
Every American who watches television can recite the Miranda warning. And of course, included in the Miranda warning is, you know, you have the right to an attorney. If you cannot afford an attorney, one will be provided for you. But that sort of Sixth Amendment promise, it's just not always realized, and very, you know, very frequently is not really realized. And if every person who was accused of a crime had access to the kind of lawyering that I was able to afford, then I think that fewer people would go to prison in the first place. And I think that people who were sentenced to prison would go for much shorter and more sensible sentences. But that's not the world that we live in right now. And so as important as race is, and there can be no question that the criminal justice system has been misused as a tool of control over communities of color, and especially poor communities of color, the other really important thing, the broader lens, is that lens of race and that question of why do we only police and prosecute and punish poor people with
right.
our criminal justice
right.
system.
I mean, that is the question. I mean, because I mean, you can see that in our society that equal numbers of white Americans and people of color use drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the actual numbers, there's more white people using drugs than there are black folks using drugs, though it's black people who are in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where the glaring, the inequities, you can see it, you can taste it. It's right there.
The racial inequity is very, very glaring, but I would also say there are plenty of wealthy people who use drugs and who may, in fact, be involved in the retailing of drugs.
Right.
And yet those folks are very unlikely to ever be policed or to be prosecuted, let alone sent to prison.
So it's interesting. I was reading an interview the other day with Angela Davis,
mm-hmm.
and she was commenting on your book and on the TV series.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a lot of critique saying that the Orange is the New Black is just a white story. But it was interesting, Angela Davis's critique was, no, it opens doors that need to be opened, that are not mm-hmm. being opened in terms of sexuality, in terms of race, in terms of life in prison and the nature of what prison guards do and what that system doesn't do. And so I'm curious, and I know Angela is somebody who believes in the abolition of the system.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I'm curious what you now advocate in terms of how we should change the system we have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Angela Davis, first of all, Angela Davis knows what she's talking about when you talk about the criminal justice system and prison system. And, you know, I'm thrilled to hear her commentary. You know, I am very pragmatic and I am very near-term, though I think Angela Davis is a visionary thinker. And I am a really pragmatic, near-term person, probably in part because I'm a communications person by training and by trade. We've made some progress over the last 10 years in terms of sort of moving the pendulum. I do think of it as this pendulum. You know, in 1980, we had about 500,000 people in prison in this country, and today we have around 2.3 million people in prison and jail, which is shocking. So that's a really harsh pendulum swing. There is incremental and I would say fairly tentative movement in a better direction of having fewer people in confinement. But, you know, there is a lot of profit and a lot of benefit in the existing status quo for many people and for many entities. And when I say entities, I include sort of the private sector. So we know, of course, that there are private prison corporations which contract to the government to hold people. We know that there are private healthcare corporations that contract the prison systems and generally do an atrocious job. We know that, you know, there are companies like Aramark, which I believe is based in Philly, which contracts to provide food services to prisons. So there's an enormous amount of money being made from those 2.3 million people who are locked up. And any time that folks have a powerful stake in the system, it makes it more challenging to get to a common sense solution. You know, I think one of the biggest things to be concerned about is lowering our prison population and getting more people out of confinement, and ideally getting more people out of the system entirely. Because even if you don't go to prison, a felony conviction is a very significant burden in terms of moving forward in your life in a progressive way. And so if you carry a felony conviction for a low-level offense, it's a serious, serious problem. So getting more people out of the system and more people out of confinement is important. I think one of the most significant areas of opportunity is when we look at how the criminal justice system overlaps with health issues. So when you're talking about substance abuse and when you're talking about mental illness, that is a big opportunity. I will tell you, having been in a women's prison and in a women's federal jail, that a huge percentage of women who are incarcerated suffer from mental illness and, you know, sometimes co-related substance abuse issues. And these problems are not well served in prison and jail. Like, prisons and jails just aren't positioned to address those problems. And on a fundamental level, making sure that mental health care and substance abuse care for the poorest Americans don't get enshrined in the criminal justice system, which is, you know, kind of where we're at right now, that's really, really important.
I, you know, one of the things that I thought, not just the series, but your book did, and what you attempt to do as well, which is really important, is to humanize the people who are incarcerated. You know, because prisons can be a very tough place, especially men's prisons, maybe women's as well, but where the violence does take place. But you saw another side of that that I think is important for you to kind of lay out for our listeners.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the reasons that it was really important for me to write my book is that I was sent to prison. I was terrified. I feared, you know, primarily, most of all, violence. I mean, of course, the separation from my family, from the outside world, those things were all, you know, sort of devastating as well, but the thing that everybody fears about prison is violence. So I personally didn't experience any violence when I was incarcerated. I didn't witness any violence. Did I see conflict? Of course, because prisons are places of scarcity by design. Like, that's actually how they're set up. You know, prisons are set up and in ways that sort of foster conflict and foster sometimes violence. That said, you know, women, including women in the criminal justice system, are really not much inclined to use violence to get what they want. So when I came home from prison in 2005, you know, people really wanted to know about the experience. You know, people that I knew and a lot of people I knew didn't have a lot of experience with the criminal justice system, didn't know anybody who had ever gone to prison or jail. And what I found is that their assumptions sort of came to from one end or the other of a sort of polarized spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
People either assumed that, you know, oh, my God, you must have been beaten up every day, which, of course, was not true. Or, interestingly, some people, and disproportionately guys, would say, oh, well, a federal prison, it must have been a country club, right?
And
that's
right.
Really not true either. And so I think that many folks, you know, the public sort of fantasizes one extreme or another when it comes to prisons and jails. Either they think about sort of the most extreme sort of gladiator, you know, horrible, violent place, or they fantasize that, in fact, prisons and jails are these rehabilitative places with lots of programming and lots of things that help people get back on their feet. And neither of those things is really true. I mean, the truth of the matter is, we have this enormous maze of prisons and jails in America. And, you know, a city or a county jail is very different than a federal minimum security prison, which in turn is very different from a state maximum security prison. Like, those settings are all going to be quite different in some ways. But the fundamental thing that people need to know is that we have put too many people into that maze of prisons and jails, and there are far too few, you know, legitimate exits out of that system. And that's a real problem.
And I think, you know, we have a tendency in this country, I think, to believe that punishment is always the answer for everything that happens. Mm-hmm. At least that's a tendency in this country. I mean, there's many tendencies, but that's one of them, clearly. And so one of the important things to do, I guess, is to talk about what the alternatives might be, you know, to incarcerating everyone who transgresses.
Yeah. Especially if you're talking about the vast number of people in the system who are there not for a violent crime, but for a nonviolent offense. And, of course, some nonviolent offenses are still serious crimes. You know, violence is what concerns us the most often. But, you know, when you look at the federal system, what you see is that about half of the federal system are people who are there for drug offenses that do not involve violence. And that is staggering. The federal prison system is, of course, the biggest prison system in the country. When you look at state systems, we see that that is true for about 25% of the people who are held in state prison. So when you think about those folks who have, you know, committed drug offenses, which are part of, you know, the sort of failed policy that's known as the war on drugs, and also when you think about folks whose primary issues are mental illness or substance abuse, that, you know, presents a huge swath of opportunity within the existing system to get people out of confinement, you know, to get them out of basically the cage. And then, you know, to look at which of those folks can potentially come out of the system entirely. As an example, you know, I'm here in New York. That's where I live. I work with the Women's Prison Association, which is a nonprofit, and it's basically a service agency that's been working with criminal justice-involved women since 1840. We launched a program last October called Justice Home, and that's a program where women who are looking at least a year in prison, you know, when their district attorney and their judge decides that it's appropriate, that instead of being sent to prison or jail, they stay home. They are monitored in their home, and they also get a host of, you know, basically services and help to help get them on a better path. And if they complete the program, then they have an opportunity to have their record expunged if their judge and their district attorney will agree. And so that's a great example of keeping people out of confinement. Now, here's what people need to know. In the state of New York, it costs about $60,000 a year to incarcerate a person. And that program, that alternative to incarceration program, costs about $17,000 a year. So, you know, there's a host of different things to consider, but that's one thing that we think is really important, is to make sure that there are more programs like that.
And I think that, I mean, what you're saying is very critically important. And I also think that, you know, the what happens in prisons, you alluded to it, there are very few programs anymore for people who are incarcerated to work through, whether they are for mental health or academic or cultural or just human growth, they don't exist anymore.
Yep. One of the most stark examples of that is higher education in prison.
Right.
So back when Bill Clinton was president, they passed this big crime bill. And one of the provisos of that crime bill was that they cut access to Pell Grants for prisoners. So prisoners could no longer get basically financial aid to help them get a college education. And that basically ended prison college programs to a large extent. There are still a handful of colleges and universities and programs that fight to make sure that people get an opportunity while they're locked up to get an education. And people, you know, debate that because they say, hey, there's people out here on the outside who are following the rules and not breaking the law, and it's hard to get a college education out here in the free world. But here's the thing. When somebody gets a college education when they're incarcerated, they just don't go back to prison. So that question of recidivism, you know, we have a two-thirds failure rate for our correctional systems. Two-thirds of people who go through prisons and jails, they go back. But people who don't go back are people who do manage to get higher education while they're locked up. And, you know, while somebody's incarcerated, that's a big opportunity if we do things better. To help them make the changes in their lives that they need to make when they're going to return to the community. And, of course, just about everybody who is locked up is going to return
coming
to the
home.
Community.
Right.
Yeah. Coming home, exactly.
Right.
So we have an interest in making sure that they don't come back brutalized, traumatized, and in worse shape than they went into prison.
Now, exactly. And I think that your, I mean, your book is very good about that, and I think that the series is very good about that, and I'm really happy you're coming to Baltimore. Piper Kerman has been with us. She's she's obviously the author of Orange is the New Black, My Year in a Woman's Prison, and she'll be coming to Baltimore for this Monday. At Center Stage as part of the Open Society Institute's Baltimore Big Change Baltimore event, and you can go to bigchangebaltimore.org to find out how to just come in and take part of it and hear Piper and the other speakers, including our dear friend Freeman Hrabowski and others, to talk about how we need to change the system we're in on numbers of levels. And Piper, one of the things I want to say is I'm really, it's refreshing to see somebody like you writing the things you write, being an advocate for this radical social change that needs to happen. So I want to thank you for all you've done.
Oh, well, thank you, Mark. You're very kind. I am really looking forward to coming to Baltimore on Monday.
We'll see you Monday.
Thanks.
Take care.
Okay.
Be safe.
Bye-bye.
We're going to take a very brief break, and during the break, coming through it, we're going to hear Drake, who was born this day in 1986. Don't go away. We're coming right back with our guest to talk about the article inspired by the Atlantic Monthly about homelessness in Baltimore. Why can't we use the empty houses to put people in them? Stay with us.
I'd agree with that. I just take my time with all this shit. I still believe in that. I had someone tell me I fell off. Ooh, I needed that. And they want to see me pick back up. Well, where'd I leave it at? I know I exaggerated things.